just moments before we started recording, Brian just said he's really excited about this one. So hopefully it's a great episode. There was just a massive landmark case that came out the week before we're recording this with the National Association of Realtors agreeing as part of a settlement to change the way residential brokerage fees are paid. This is really big news. Everyone's talking about it. There's a lot of hysteria in the mass media. There's a lot of talking heads on Twitter. We're going to chime in on this. John, why don't you kick us off? Explain what happened, explain where we stand today, and then let's dive into a discussion on how things might not totally be what they seem.
Love to. Yeah, I think it's fascinating. And others can chime in if they've interpreted it a different way. I think there's three primary changes to the way residential agents are to be paid. There was a requirement that these realtors belong to the MLS. So they're doing away with that. There's no requirement. You can't require that they belong to the MLS. When they belong to the MLS and they listed their buildings, their homes on the MLS, they would list the commission that was to be paid. And so they've done away with that. They're no longer allowed to list the commission to be paid on the MLS because that had that the subtle, it sort of drove people to rely on those commissions. And that's the way the buyer's agent got paid. Anyway, so no longer allowed to be required to be an MLS member and no longer allowed to list the commission to be paid on that MLS listing. And the third thing that I think is material is this idea that the buyers now need to have contracts with the buyer's agents. Okay, so if we start to think about, okay, what's the impact of all of that? It's funny, it makes residential real estate more like our business is today, where in both commercial and in residential, commissions are always negotiable. But that whole structure around the MLS was sort of implied that maybe they weren't. And if you wanted to play along, you had to play along. It makes their business more like ours, whereas a buyer's agent needs to ask, what's the fee scheduled to be paid? And okay, I'll get more to like the net result of all that later. And yes, now that we're emphasizing this idea that commissions are always negotiable, you're going to have some sellers who maybe don't want to build in a buyer's fee and leave that to the buyer, right? But that's like in our business, we encounter landlords all the time who don't want to pay a commission or maybe don't want to pay a commission on a lease renewal. And we have to navigate that and it's hard. So one result is it's going to make this business of residential real estate a little less fun and a little less easy. And I do think we'll see some of the agents who are just sort of doing it on the margin, selling a couple homes every year, go away because it's not worth it. It's going to make it a little bit harder. But the other thing about those sellers, like our landlords who maybe get a little tight on commissions, the funny thing about those building owners that I've encountered is typically they're not just cheap in that way. They're cheap in every way. So it turns out those are often the buildings that are maybe not in great condition or repair. And, you know, they don't get the same kind of volume and the same kind of traffic. It's not necessarily the brokers are steering to the bigger commissions. It's just that those are difficult landlords to deal with. And sometimes life's too short. I think there will be sellers who try and clip the fee or don't build in a buyer side fee. And I think, it'll make the business less fun and agents have to go ask what the commission. I'm going to stop there and let you all chime in. I mean, I've identified three changes. I think those are the primary ones. Do you agree? And what's your take on that change? And later I want to come back and talk about what I think really plays out over time, as a net result of this change, which is maybe not as big of a change in my view, ultimately. But what do you all have to say?
John, I think I'll start with the comment you made about making the industry less fun. I mean, it will make it less fun for the agents that don't add value, probably don't know the market, and are just used to being able to use relationships, get a listing and make 3%, but really adds very little value. I think this change opens the playing field for people to perform better, know the market better, be more value add to their clients, and makes it really fun for them because they could probably make more money, right? And it aligns the incentive with, which is the commission, to the value, hopefully, that they create a couple different ways. One, like our business, I think the listing agent, the listing broker, is becoming quickly replaced by technology, right? There's lots of places the you can go and list your home. There's a lot of places you can get the information for listing your home. So being the listing agent who just has a couple open houses and sells a house, and allows the buyer's agent really to run the whole process for them, is becoming marginalized and probably going to make a lot less money, and probably a lot of them are going to go out of the business. I think the buyer's agent, which is bringing the value, which is the buyer who has, you know, the need and the want, is going to be, is the good ones are going to be valued even more. They're the ones that are going to have good buyers. They're going to understand a process to be able to navigate inexperienced buyers through it. So they are either one, successful in their pursuit of a particular home, or two, don't fall into any of the pitfalls or roadblocks that can come through a process that they're not used to. And it makes the whole deal better, makes it more seamless. It makes the results hopefully better, and they should get paid more for that. And, you know, like our business, there's, the agents that represent the users get paid, you know, roughly two times what the agents that represent the owners get. Rather than it be, and this is on the leasing side, I think on a sales side, it could be 50-50 at times, but maybe not if it's a user sale. But the I think the market's going to shift where they put the value to who deserves it, which is the agents that that represent the tenants or the buyers. And the the marketplace is, you know, in hysteria. The media is in hysteria. They think, you know, I saw a number as 30% of agents may, you know, may go away. Fees may be reduced significantly. And all, I think all that is just clickbait for, you know, mass hysteria around a story that's very big and very impactful to really anyone who owns a home or wants to own a home.
Yeah. And I think that's, you're right. And it's what we've seen. What's what we see in the commercial side where, you know, a 6% fee split 3 and 3, maybe over time becomes a 4% fee to the buyer's agent and a 2% fee to the listing agent. And interesting also to note a difference between commercial and residential, that 2% fee to the listing firm in the commercial is worth it, especially when the landlord is institutional and represents a portfolio of properties. But in residential, that's not the case. It's like it's distributed. It's a distributed client base, and they're one-off primarily for the most part. Right. So that 2% fee is, like you said, at risk of being disrupted by technology. Whereas the buyer side agent, I think, is finding themselves in a position of power and may actually be in a better position to defend a 3% fee and maybe even and take it higher.
My comments on this is simple. It's about where you add value. Okay, and in my opinion, I've both bought and sold homes in my life. And when I've sold homes, I've been pretty unimpressed with the service that I was delivered. And it wasn't that I hired an agent who wasn't competent. He's actually a great agent. And I would use him if I had to buy a house in a heartbeat. But on the sales side, you know, I felt like what I was getting was just a sign in front of my yard and a few photos of my house, and I got put on the MLS. And I think that's why companies like Redfin have accelerated so well, is because they're putting more eyes on your home by putting it on their own platform, which is the number one downloaded real estate app in the App Store. They get you preferred placement and search results, digital marketing, 3D tours. That really, that's what matters, because frankly, when I'm looking for a home, I'm looking at it on this device, right? Like I'm on an app and I'm just scrolling, looking at photos and so forth. And I don't need an agent for that. So my point is like what I care about if I'm selling a house is getting it in front of as many people as possible, because I know people are looking at phones on their iPads and their phones and their computers. What's that worth? I don't know. Like let's let that be a discussion, because Redfin certainly charges less than 3%. And if someone wants to pay 3% for, I would suggest, even worse service, go for it. But you allow the competition to drive the fees. Now, on the buy side, completely different scenario from my opinion. I bought a house once where it was a very tight market and there was multiple bids, competing bids for that matter. And my wife and I very much wanted this home. And I relied heavily on my agent on trying to figure out how to strategize our offer to make it most compelling without, of course, overpaying for the real estate. And she did a fantastic job. And, you know, she was certainly also dealing with two emotional people because my wife and I very much wanted this home. And so I think there's like a tremendous amount of value in the buyer's agent fee. And what I did pay her 3%. I'd gladly pay her 3% all day because the percentage point here or there, which could have resulted in not getting the home I wanted, should I had gone with someone that charged less, wasn't worth it to me. But again, I think it's on the, depending on what you're doing, who you're representing, I think negotiable fees are fantastic.
I think the most important takeaway from this is that the National Association of Realtors, which was almost this like quasi-government entity. I mean, they're not a government entity, right? But like they had so much power, like monopolistic type power over the entire residential market. This group has now been completely neutered. They no longer have this power. This is a good thing for consumers. This is a good thing for brokers. We don't need this crazy powerful intermediary between every single realtor and every single buyer or seller of a home. And the fact that this doesn't exist anymore obviously sucks if you're, you know, like a board member at NAR getting paid all this money to, you know, seize control and hang on to power by any means that you can. But like net net, this is good. And it allows people to get paid what is fair, whether that be what they're being paid now, whether it be more, whether it be less, whether it be total shifting. So net net, I think, you know, this is a good thing that there's not one entity involved of determining what everyone in this entire industry is paid.
Okay, let me give you two more net nets. This is just my take. I'm curious what you all think. The discussion is like maybe we become more like Europe, for example, where the buyers pay the buyer agent's fee, both in commercial and in residential. That's not the case in commercial here in the U.S. And here's why I don't think that'll come to pass. Like, I think there's enough inertia around the current model where if you want to sell your home, if I wanted to sell my home, I would include a buyer's side commission in my agreement. I want a buyer's agent to know that I'm going to pay their fee. If I'm in a sign a listing agreement that says, no, the buyer has to take care of their own fee, like, I don't want to discourage the buyer side agents, the one who add all that value, from showing my home. So I think inertia will keep it in the current model. It'll just force a conversation about commissions are always negotiable. How much are we paying the listing side fee and how much are we going to pay the buyer side fee? But I think this discussion that we're going to become like Europe and the buyers are going to pay the buyer side agents is not going to come to pass, at least not in the near term. What do you think?
If buyers have to start paying their agents directly in residential real estate, then that will be devastating for the entire industry. It'll be devastating for buyers, brokers, and they will simply cease to exist, or they will be reduced by 80-90%, right? People that are doing residential real estate that are really competent, that are great leaders, great sort of service providers, if they can't make a living doing residential real estate, then they're going to go do something else, right? And there's a lot of very capable, competent people that will just go get other jobs. And ultimately, and we're, I think, a unique group. All of us have, you know, bought and sold, you know, residential and commercial real estate. We're, I think, more sophisticated when it comes to real property transactions than just about anyone. Not to, you know, like pat our own backs, but like this is what we do. And when you think about the vast majority of homes that are sold in the U.S., I mean, like these are people that have no experience with real estate that might transact once every 20 years or once in their lifetime. And they still need help doing this. What I could see happening on a longer term time horizon, which is only made possible because of, you know, what's happened with this, you know, NAR settlement case, is that there might be a fee for service alternative that emerges where it's basically like you find the property and we'll be in charge of providing this service. And with our service, we'll write three offers. We'll help you with the inspections. We'll help you review the purchase and sale agreement. And we'll do a couple of other things. We'll review the title report and, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And if you think about the pricing model for buying a $500,000 home, right? Right now, if a 6% fee is being paid, right? You just start thinking about like, okay, if I'm going to pay $30,000 to buy a home, right? And this residential real estate agent is maybe going to do 20 or 30 hours of work, right? It's this implied hourly rate of like $1,000 an hour. is the value that they're providing worth $1,000 an hour on a contingency basis where you potentially get paid zero? Probably, right? Like that doesn't seem crazy if you have real expertise. But if you're guaranteed that money and more of a fee for service, like the legal industry, to be paid $200 or $300 an hour as like a non-attorney, but as somebody that has real experience processing transactions, doesn't seem crazy. And can you do it in less than 30 hours or less than 10 hours or 20 hours if you have some technology-enabled platform that allows you to be really efficient going through these transactions? Maybe. So I think that's the biggest risk of disruption is that you go to a fee-for-service, like paid hourly or retainer basis on both sides. And that could really change the industry. But John, I generally agree with you. I think that the concentration of giant residential real estate companies in the country is pretty tight. There's a lot of power that's held by the, you know, Douglas Elliman's, the Compasses of the world. There's a ton of money behind this space. And I think that they will ultimately figure out a way for buyer agents to be paid by sellers still. And that's an important consideration to be able to make sure that that buyer's fee is financeable, right? Like with included in the full purchase price. So you can, you know, get a mortgage against that amount.
Yeah. Tucker, you just brought up a really good point, the fee for service model, because if you look at it purely on that $30,000 commission on a $500,000 home, it's a lot of money. You know, it's, you know, I think the average American makes like $54,000 a year or something like that. So it's a lot of money on the surface. The scary part is that most buyers, like you said, are unsophisticated in the sense that they don't have experience doing this. And if you compare it to the legal profession, you've got 3 years of advanced education. You've got one of the most difficult standardized tests in all of standardized testing. And you've got a very high bar in terms of your ethics and your quality and your ability and access to information about the lawyers, the law firms, and their clients. And then you have the residential real estate industry, which, you know, at one point in time was dominated by part-time agents and still has a big portion of their, you know, of the people that operate the industry as part-time agents that, you know, probably are not adding the value that somebody who does this full-time as their profession can add. And then now you say, okay, we're going to turn this into a fee-for-service model with volume. We're going to charge you half price. Well, it's scary to think that the people that probably need the most out of their agents because they're just inexperienced in transacting are the ones that look at it and say, oh, if I can only pay 15 grand, maybe this is a great move, and then get half the value. And what does that mean in terms of their, some of the situations they get themselves in, what they pay, what they sell it for? Like it could just snowball. So I'm hopeful. I think it's good that I think the industry will thin out because value will start to flow to the people that add the most. And others will have to get out of the industry because they don't add a lot of value. I've been saying for a long time, we need, you know, somewhere, I say 50%, but it's probably somewhere more like 10 to 20% of commercial brokers to exit this business, because for the last 10 years, it's been such an easy industry for a lot of brokers, that are, not capable of actually adding real value to their clients. And, you know, we need a good recession to kind of wipe the industry out. Well, maybe this is the same thing with the residential market, and it kind of retrenches to a pool of agents that are much more aligned with adding value to their clients than somebody who's just a weekend warrior, you know, picking up listings from people at church.
Well said. I'll add one thing. You just mentioned recession, I think you said. But yeah, pay attention to the cycle, right? Because that shift in the power to the buyer's agent occurs in the down cycle when buyers are fewer and farther between. And all of a sudden, if you want them, you know, they need to be paid. And that's where they can maybe shift the goalpost on the percentage of the commission that's going to the buyer's agent. We have that experience in our business on the tenant or user side. You know, it's the down markets where we get busy and we're more in demand. I think so. For now, it's still a seller's market in most places. As it shifts to the buyer's market, pay attention to the cycle. I think that's when we'll see the power shift to the buyer side agent. And then one more point, kind of why I don't think this ultimately will be a big change. I think inertia will keep it largely the way it is now with the buyer's fee embedded in the seller's listing agreement. Because think about it, some buyers now or some sellers now will say, I want to list the home for sale. I'm going to pay you a 2% commission and I'm not paying a buyer's commission. Okay. And I don't think that home is going to get a whole bunch of traffic or whatnot, but if it's a nice home and somebody wants to buy it, now that buyer has to say, okay, I got to go shop for a buyer's agent. I'm actually going to have to write a check to pay this person to represent me. Some of them will be tempted to go it alone. And I predict that will in certain cases have a disastrous outcome followed by lawsuits. Like to drive buyers away from working through an agent by putting the burden on them of actually stroking the check, writing, paying for that agent to represent them will drive some folks to go it alone. And I think that will have bad outcomes. And it's just one more reason. I think the current model works. It just has, everyone has to be reminded that commissions are negotiable and you can't be forced to, list the fee, show the fee. And everyone's just got to, it's a little bit more like the Wild West. You got to ask, you got to compete. And as you've all spoken to, you got to add the value if you want to earn a fee.
It's a really good point. Like if you're selling a home, you probably want the other side to be represented, because if there's something happens downstream, it's not on you as the seller. Like if you're selling it directly to a buyer, there's kind of that burden of responsibility that might be placed on you as the seller versus they're represented. They have a professional. If something gets missed or something doesn't get stated correctly on your end, it's not my fault as the seller. Like the burden's not on me. And that'll be interesting how that plays out in the courts. Cause I guarantee you're right. There's going to be buyer's remorse and they're going to blame it on the seller. And there's no intermediary that's a professional that helps figure this stuff out. It'll be interesting how that plays out.
I think in practice, the idea of saying, hey, wouldn't it be great if we didn't need accounting firms anymore because financial reporting was so easy? Like that sounds great. Like I would love if I could file my own taxes instead of having to spend a bunch of money and, you know, collect all these forms and, you know, put together some giant document with the help of tax professionals, right? But like the reality is that real estate transactions, just because of this ruling, have not gotten simpler, right? They're the same level of difficulty. And that level of difficulty exceeds probably 99% of the population's ability to do it consistently, time in, time out, without making a mistake, without creating, you know, legal liability or, you know, some sort of future issue that could be really expensive for both parties. So the value add that, realtors and residential real estate agents have been providing, like that value still needs to be provided. They might just get paid differently. So let's move on from the NAR subject. Spent a good 20 minutes on it. Brian said he was excited to talk about it. We all can tell he was clearly excited. So he delivered on that. Let's move to the next topic. So something that I really wanted to talk about that I think is super interesting and helpful contextually for all of our listeners is there was a new report that came out that tracks cell phone data that compares U.S. building foot traffic over time compared to 2019 as a baseline. So in April of 2020, right, which this was like peak hysteria for COVID, we're really the only people across most of the country that were allowed to be in the office were like critical, super important industries, imperative to the supply chain or, you know, medical or defense or different things like that. And at that time, it was down 89% as compared to 2019. This is 89% in April 2020. Then it was down 80% in January of 2021, 67% in January of 2022, and then a massive jump in 2022 from 67 down to 44% in January of 2023. Now we're down from 44% last year to around 37% this year. And all of these are compared to the 2019 baseline, right? So you start thinking about that, like the most material jump, which was surprising to me, was in between January of 2022 and January of 2023. Like to remind everyone, the wide availability of COVID vaccines was really in the first half of 2021, where everyone began getting vaccinated. So it's interesting that, you know, the drop from 2021 to 2022, when people were being vaccinated, was basically like half of the drop that we experienced from 2022 to 2023. So a couple thoughts and a few questions for the group. One, do you think that we're going to continue to see this sort of on average year over year reduction in 7 or 8% or maybe 5%? Or do you think that we're kind of done? Like, where do you think this number is going to go? If we're at 37% compared to 2019, are we ever going to get back? I think we've talked a lot saying that we're not going to get back. But if we're not going to get back, what percent do we get to? I have my own thoughts. I'm very curious to hear what you all think.
I've been saying for a long time that I think let me summarize. Do I think we're going to get back to where we were pre-COVID? No, I do not. What I do think could really shift the needle and push it where more people are coming back than otherwise is when a company who adheres to being back in the workplace as a team, whether that be 3, 4, 5 days a week, could be 5, starts outperforming those who are remote or largely remote, that will be the thing that tips the scale. And I think we need time to figure that out and for that to play itself out. You know, there's some who are staunch advocates of being back because they suggest that you can work better, collaborate more, and it's more accretive to your culture. Others are staunch advocates of the opposite, suggesting that they're more productive at home. It gives people freedom. It reduces commute times, a happy workforce, etc. And so I'm just always been a firm believer that, look, you're entitled to your own opinion. I'm entitled to mine. And let's just agree to disagree if that's where we'd land. But let time shake things out. And I think, like I said, we've only been really, I say we as a society, have only really been back in the office on whatever this hybrid schedule is for some, for better part of a year, maybe more, but I think like it's too early to tell. So I think it's, you know, fast forward to 2025, 2026, I think that's where the pendulum will settle. And there'll be, dare I say an overused term, new normal, but, you know, will that be the point of time in which I think we have flatlined at whatever that occupancy rate may be? Yes, I do. But I don't think we're there. And do I think it's going to increase beyond where it is today? That's where I'm in the camp of yes. I think it will, because I think you can do more as a team. But I could be wrong. So let's see where things end up in 2 years.
I would say this. And, you know, it's we all talk to a lot of office tenants every day, our clients and office tenants in the marketplace. And I would say on average, they're all needing something less, call it on average 20%. Maybe it's a range of 10% to 30%, but, you know, things have changed for office utilization in a way that's foundational. And so I think if 2019 were to remain the baseline, I would predict that we would return to 20% and as representing the new full occupancy load. But here's the other thing to realize: the denominator is going to change over time. Office inventory is going to come out of the inventory, either through conversion to residential, which isn't easy, but is happening in some cases, or by a wrecking ball, these older buildings. So there's no point in keeping an old building around and trying to get at least, it's functionally obsolete. So I would peg the number at 20% to the 2019 baseline. And I would remind us all that over time, the actual baseline the denominator is going to change. So maybe we get back to the occupancy level of 2019, but it's over a lesser total inventory of office space.
Great point, John. I was going to do reference the same and add to it, though. The denominator changes for a couple of reasons, because inventory changes, but also I think if a company takes less space, right, and more companies... So if you have 100,000 feet in a building and you're only showing up 3 days a week, you restructure your lease to take 60,000 feet and another company takes the 40,000 feet, and then you start to show up 3 days a week and they're showing up 3 days a week, all of a sudden that building is filling up in a different way, rather than half of the building sitting vacant because of shadow vacancy, because you just aren't going to drive that many people there anymore. So I think the denominator changes and how we're going to be seeing these office buildings, the ones that survive, come out of this this cycle will be interesting to watch. So the number 37 is just interesting. So that's just under 3 days in the office, 2 days at home, right? So I like that John actually put a number to it. So if 1 day is 20%, 2 days is 40%, we're already below that 3 days a week, which I kind of believe was the number. So I'm going to go with 33.33% as a, you know, as a, an ode to Larry Bird and the Boston Celtics. But I think it's going to settle around 33% is where I'm at. January of 25, we can look back on this episode and see where we are.
And we will. You know, we will come back and post that, fact check you. Almost certainly anyone that gives a to the decimal hypothesis is going to be wrong. Maybe not by much, but I'm pretty confident you're going to be wrong. So we'll make sure to document that and throw it on LinkedIn, blast it out, get like push notifications going, whatever we need to do. Okay, cool. Well, thanks for the hypotheses here. I think we're going to do a little bit better than 33.3%. The other thing that I'll add, and you know, Brian talked about this a little bit, it's so important to recognize that even if we're in a permanent state where we're at 33.3% or 20% or 25%, that doesn't mean that the office market is in terrible shape. I mean, to be clear, the office market is in terrible shape right now. But just because companies are only occupying office space 3 or 4 days a week instead of 5 days a week, from many landlords and, you know, building owners' perspective, it doesn't really matter because that hasn't materially changed the way people lease space, right? Nobody has found a novel way to say, oh, company A needs space Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Let's take that underutilized capacity on Monday, Friday and do something else with it. Nobody's figured that out, given the nature of you know, every company having a unique setup and confidential things in offices and people wanting to, you know, create a sense of community and being able to have meetings on the days where maybe not everyone is as active in the office. Nobody's figured out how to use this underutilized, you know, space. And if somebody can figure it out, that is most certainly a, you know, multi, you know, billion, maybe, you know, 100+ billion dollar opportunity. But a lot of smart people have been thinking about that for 4 years now, and nobody's come up with anything good.
It occurs to me, I want to add one little factoid here, because using that 2019 as a baseline, I wonder how many people realize I visited with a tech company in a well-known brand name tech company that you would recognize in the Bay Area, and their real estate team was very forward-looking and thoughtful and smart and experimenting on themselves all the time and reconfiguring their space and measuring how it would change utilization. And they had sensors on everything, right? They weren't using cell phone data. They were actually using sensors. And what was fascinating is pre-pandemic, when they're all stacked in tech companies, you can imagine the density, their utilization number was around 50%. Like, if people are thinking that in 2019, we were using 100% of our real estate all the time, it's just that wasn't. And the issue then was like they were spending so much for their real estate and only getting a 50% utilization rate. So they were still struggling with how do we get people in more of the time. But just to point out for the listeners, this idea that in 2019, the number wasn't 100% utilization for companies that were being effective at, you know, drawing people in and getting people to interact. It was still, even for them, it was only about 50% utilization.
Yeah. And I think that is low. I think the number that I've always kind of gravitated towards is 70, 75%, right? So, it's 25% below that, but it's not 100. Your point's well taken. I think what'll be interesting to do, to see, is how this impacts, you know, future development, how it impacts old redevelopment of old space, and, you know, where all that settles out, because where that denominator goes, I think drives a lot of this high level data. And it's just one anecdote. Like we put a sublease on the market in Boston's Back Bay, and, it's in, no lie, probably one of the worst buildings in the Back Bay. It's Class C. It's got an owner that's challenged, who has reputationally challenged in the market, is just being difficult. And they were small floors. I think they were like 4,500 square feet per floor. And it drove tons of tours. People wanted the space, multiple offers. They wanted to be in this building. Why? Because there's just not a lot of small suites back here, and everyone wants to be in the back bay. So people will sacrifice for location in certain situations for these, I think, these smaller spaces. It's just so interesting because that just kind of flips on its head my whole premise that, you know, people are gravitating towards better buildings. They're gravitating towards better buildings if there are suites. I mean, they could have got the same 4,000 square feet in the 200 Clarendon, 100 net versus this building at, you know, probably 30 gross. I don't know what we have it on the market on, but it's probably something like 30 or 40 gross. So there's a huge difference. There's just nothing in between. So, you know, it's just funny to see where this all settles out. It's hard. It's so hard to understand.
But I think that's consistent with the whole, every metro market across the country right now, where there is a abundance of full floor subleases in every major metro market. But I dare I say, scarcity of smaller suites. I wouldn't say scarcity of smaller suites, but those that are, you know, for sublease at discounted rents, because those are what's in demand right now. It's the large full floor blocks where you're able to drive truly phenomenal terms, even on a direct basis, because there is so little demand and there is so much sublease supply. And we're starting to see landlords starting to capitulate to all of the sublease supply, where they're having to compete for full floor tenants. And so your comment about this Class C building having activity, frankly, doesn't surprise me. We're seeing the same throughout Seattle and San Francisco, where I've got clients that are looking for 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 square feet. And there's just not as much inventory as there are these big full floors. And for those listeners that, you know, are wondering, why don't they just go on these full floors? The reason being is that demising costs is extremely expensive. Meaning if you take a full floor to carve off, you know, 4,000 feet, you're having to add common corridors, both to the restrooms and the emergency stairwells, and it just gets cost prohibitive. So even though you might see a lot of full floor availabilities, which are driving vacancy, rates throughout major metro markets, those are not applicable to those people needing less. So, fact of matter, I'm seeing across the country in every major market I'm representing tenants in.
So I think, Brian, you stumbled on something brilliant. And I think we've implied this many times on the pod, but we've maybe never said it out loud. The truth is there are multiple reasons a Class A building is Class A, or multiple reasons a highly desirable building is highly desirable. And it, you know, it's the age of the building, newer buildings, high performance glass, amenities on site, access to natural light and outdoor. There's all sorts of things that make a cool building cool. But you just hit on, like, there's a distinct measurable factor. It's location. Like, that building is highly sought because of its location, and all the other stuff almost doesn't matter. And then, like, here I am surprised to be making this point that there's all these different elements and location is maybe the most important one, but everyone remembers that little adage about real estate, right? Location, location, location. So I'm not sure this is new, like post-pandemic and shifting work styles and models. It's everything old is new again. Location, location, location is the maybe the key driver in Class A.
Oh. Yeah, but the interesting piece for me was that this is a building that you would slate to be torn down and converted to something else. Like, on paper, you'd be like, oh, that's a perfect site for a small boutique hotel or residential or student housing or, you know, multi-story retail because of the location on a major street that has multi-story retail. Like, down the street's the Apple store that's six stories, right? And instead, it's highly sought after classy office space. And so it gives me hope that, you know, a lot of this, once we kind of retrench, people come back to good markets, good location, and if you're an owner of some of these buildings, you just kind of probably have to weather the storm and let the marketplace come to you to a certain extent as, you know, as everything kind of normalizes again. That's kind of my take on it.
Hey, let's bring this back to Tucker's earlier comment about his Placer AI data that he was reading about. Because as Brian was excited to talk about the NAR ruling on residential real estate commissions, I was equally excited to talk about this topic, which I'm about to dive in on. regarding commercial real estate loans. And we want to make this a discussion because I think this is the single biggest risk for the commercial real estate market that will affect both landlords and what tenants are able to achieve in their buildings that they choose to occupy space in. So for anyone following Jerome Powell's comments, he's our Federal Reserve Chair, of course. Last week, he sent shockwaves through the financial world, as some might call it, where he referenced the delinquency rates for commercial mortgage-backed securities are on the rise again in recent months. Now, despair, panic, they're not where they were in 2008, but they're certainly on the rise. And the reason he sent markets into panic was because of the following quote. And I think it's worth restating on this pod for those that didn't read the articles. So I'm going to read it. He said, as referencing the loans, of course, "This is a problem we'll be working on for years, I'm sure. There will be bank failures," he said. "It's not a first order issue for any of the very large banks. It's more smaller and medium sized banks that have these issues." He went on to say, "We're working with them. We're getting through it. I think it's manageable," is the word I would use. So I think what threw markets into turmoil is that he said, "I quote, think it's manageable and that we'll be, quote, working on it for years and there will be bank failures." And so, you know, Powell's job is to calm the markets, not to send them into a complete and utter tailspin. But he also has a fiduciary to kind of tell it how it is. And so I think he did a pretty good job of toting the line. But those that are like me and, you know, tied into this industry so closely, I read through the tea leaves and could see what was going on. And so I went to dig in further. And this is what I wanted a discussion on. So our debt market is poised to have a record-breaking event this year as $929 billion of loans are to mature. Again, just shy of a trillion this year in 2024, okay? There's an additional trillion coming due in 2025 and 2026. And get this, these maturities, which are happening again this year, 25 and 26, represent 42% of all commercial real estate debt. That's for multifamily, office, industrial, retail, everything. And what's really masking this kind of tsunami, as I'm calling it, at sea heading for our coast, is that last year there were a ton of extensions and loan-term modifications that helped mask this early distress that have been signaled in certain property types, much like office. However, this uptick that we're seeing now and definitely over the next 2 years is a growing concern. And so the overall commercial real estate debt market as a whole is $2.1 billion. And the biggest component of that $2.1 billion is office. Second is multifamily. So with office accounting for $737 billion, or 48% of loans coming due between now and 2026 is a huge concern. And the question I have for, you know, those on this message or those in this pod is, you know, are we going to work through this like we did in 2008? Or is the lack of demand, like we were talking about with the Placer AI data that Tucker was talking about, and Brian's hypothesis that only 33.33% of the people are going to be back at the office, is that going to spell, or lead to an absolute collapse in the debt markets when these office buildings have to face the music? Open it up for discussion.
So first of all, you were saying 2 billion when you meant 2.2 trillion, just to be clear. Restate that. What is the total scale of the problem? Say it again.
John, thanks for that comment. I noticed that as I was talking, I figured I would have an opportunity to correct myself again. And so, no, there's over $2 trillion of commercial debt, of which $737 billion of that is office. And that's all coming due by 2026. So a huge component. Nearly half of the commercial debt that's out there in the markets is related to office buildings. And with Tucker's earlier comment and Brian's hypothesis that only 33% of the people are ever going to go back to the office at some sort of regular schedule, you know, what's that going to do to both the office buildings themselves and our financial markets as all this debt comes due, and how are people going to refinance?
By the way, unfortunately, you know who the single largest holder of all that debt is? It's you and me. It's the taxpayer. $1 trillion is agency debt, you know, Fannie Mae and agency debt. So we're on the hook for that. And I think the next biggest was $500 billion. I don't remember who the next largest was, but the single largest is the taxpayer, unfortunately. And here's what I was going to say about Jerome Powell speaking now. So it's the first time he's waded into the conversation about commercial real estate and office space and loans. So that's significant. And yes, I would agree that his job is to calm markets, but I would further specify that the way they intend to calm markets is by avoiding surprises. They want to get way out in front of things that are going to be happening. And, you know, so he's talking about this early, which here's why I think that's important. There's this contrast between really alarmist headlines in the Wall Street Journal and Barron's and everywhere about the problem. And, but if you look, as you alluded to, the default rates and the compare it to the height of the financial crisis, and we're nowhere near that today. So you could look at it and think this is all overblown. You know, why are people being so alarmist? But it's like there's a hurricane just offshore headed our way, but it's sunny and calm, right? Well, kind of. It's just a little breeze today. But it's coming, and it's likely to hit land. And, you know, how big is it going to be? We'll have to see. You could see some lowering of interest rates that maybe gives some of these lenders a chance to actually refinance and get out of the problem. That doesn't seem likely in the near term in a significant way. But there's a difference between what's being reported and what we're experiencing today. And it's because the hurricane is still offshore, but it's headed this way.
So one thing, the 33% I had talked about earlier was where we will end up as a reduction off of the 2019 number. So the it's actually 66% will be in the office. Just, you know, to clarify my position on that. But I think, John, your point, we are deleveraging our balance sheet through quantitative tightening. And it'll be interesting to see how that impacts all of this, because the United States government is, they've kind of flipped and is quietly deleveraging our balance sheet to reduce our exposure to all sorts of debt, including commercial real estate debt. But the, you know, I had a very strong opinion about this one way. And then I just had lunch with someone who's a consultant to the banking industry, and he's sitting in the boardrooms with these banks. And the opinion he had was this is all overblown. To summarize, I think he said, look, real estate is a non-core asset for these institutions. It's a portion of an overall balance sheet. Yes, when they go to refinance, they're going to want owners to put more equity into deals, and that's going to require some owners to walk away. It's going to require others, lenders, to take over assets. He said, but the percentage of these banks that real estate is of their overall assets, he said, we think this is overblown, and it's pretty diversified around. United States has a lot of lending institutions, and it's diversified enough where he doesn't see, just, you know, from what he's seeing, he doesn't see this as being as big of a problem as everyone's talking it out to be, which to me, I thought it was just the opposite, having lived through a couple of different cycles and looking at the value. I mean, even in life science space, Alexandria, the largest life science owner in the country, you know, they had sold off $700 million of non-core assets. Well, it was just announced last week that he sold a property in South Boston for $13 million, which is a development site that they had bought just a couple of years ago for $31 million, right? So, like, that's just a small example of just how quickly asset values can deteriorate. And I thought that's going to have a massive trickle-down effect through all these lenders. But somebody who's certainly closer to the industry than I am right now is not seeing it with his clients and the different boards he sits on and clients he advises. So I don't know where this is going to end up. I think the retrenching is coming. It may not be as impactful to the industry as some of us might think or thought.
Well, look, we know who they are. This is from site called the Visual Capitalist. They list the commercial real estate exposure for the U.S. banks, and they've got 25 or so on here. It starts at 68.6% of total CRE loans. The share of the total CRE loans that are a percentage of their total loans starts at 63% and gets down to 42.6%. Like if half of your loans are in CRE, that's a problem. So I'll just name the top five. Bank of the Ozark is number one at 68.6% of their loans in CRE. Number two is Home Bank Shares. Three is Pacific Premier Bank Corp. Number four is International Bank Share Shares Corporation. Number five is New York Community Bank Corp. With a footnote, they just reported a revised $2.7 billion loss in Q4 2023. Over 10 times higher than what it had initially stated.
But John, but think about it. Those five banks may add up to, you know, 1% of JP Morgan's balance sheet, right? It could be just a percentage game they're playing in that list where the overall actual value of those loans doesn't equate to, you know, a very small percentage of the overall exposure in the industry to the major banks, right? It's just these banks went all in on commercial real estate. You know, there's a game they play in banking, right? And this has been described to me in much more detail, but you're a small bank. You got to grow, you got to go public, and you've got to cash out. And that's just the game they play or get acquired. And you got to go big. And some of these banks just over leverage themselves. You know, I know some other people do auditing for the credit unions, and it's the same thing. Like the risk profile of some of these banks is absurd. And those banks, the Bank of the Ozarks, I mean, what's their balance sheet? And, you know, who knows? It's probably nothing compared to some of the more critical institutions. So if they were to go away tomorrow, is it really going to be a big deal? My guess is probably not. And so, as a percentage, it means something, but as a percentage of our overall banking system and loans outstanding, it's probably nothing.
Well, Bank of the Ozarks total assets, $32.8 billion. That New York Community Bank that was on number five, $111.2 billion total assets. By the way, I think we talked about this, I don't remember what episode, but there was a time when we were scratching our head because there was a developer going forward with some life science projects when there was a lack of demand, the market had already turned, but they went forward with new construction of these lab buildings. It was Sterling Bay and Harrison Street out here in San Diego. And we looked at, like, where are they getting their money? Bank of the Ozarks. Circle, come full circle on that one. We'll see how they do.
John, if the number five on that list, by the way, New York Community Bank, I believe just got a $1 billion cash infusion to shore up the balance sheet. So, I mean, for those top five, I'm sure the reckoning is coming. But I think in terms of the overall system, and is it going to be as big of a deal as what some think in terms of commercial real estate overall? I don't know. I'll have to see. I thought it was. That was where I was. And then the more it doesn't happen, the more we continue to kind of, you know, pretend it's not there, the more confidence I have that there may be a way out of this without seeing pure carnage across the industry. Who knows?
Okay, great discussion. Let's wrap up there. Thanks, everyone, for listening to episode 31, and we will be back with the next episode soon. Thanks.